Shoes. Recorded live.
Well, hello everyone. It's Rick, and give me just a minute here while I get my act together. It is February the 8th, 2010, and got a bunch of people online this morning, so we'll just jump right into this thing and get started. So, the first question here, I watched my husband struggle. And by the way, if any of you are on the call from this EMS this past weekend, Stephanie and I want you to know, and Leslie, what an absolute blessing it was to have you be a part of our lives. Thank you for blessing us. Okay, hang on just a second. The question titled change is mine from last week. Okay, so I won't do change again.
Okay.
I'm reading stuff here. So, but I watched my husband struggle isn't from last week. So, let's see. It's so painful. See, I watch my husband struggle every day. It's so painful to watch. He's no longer with his affair partner, and as far as I know, he has no feelings for her. Hate to be naive, but it does seem that he doesn't. So when I say the change in his heart, I don't mean as far as the affair partner is concerned. What I mean is the change in his heart that led him to be the person that was unfaithful. This keeps him somewhat disconnected from me, the person who gets antsy because he can't break away from his family, the person who's irritated because he wants to go out and have a good time but can't because his wife is sick again, the person who thinks of what he wants and needs before what his wife and children need, the person who's so scared of even think of letting the Lord in because he doesn't want to become a religious nut, the man who is so worried about maintaining a certain air of importance about him, the man who can't thank me for going through this horror and not blurting out his weaknesses to everyone we know. The man who was in counseling yesterday and said, I'd like to spend more time together. And when asked, what do you think your wife wants? The man who lets his small the man who can't thank me for going through this horror and not blurting out his weakness to everyone we know. The man who in counseling yesterday said, I would like to spend more time together when asked, what do you think your wife wants? The man who lets his small children play on the computer for 6 to 7 hours because he likes to play and he doesn't see anything wrong with it. The man who will draw the checking account down the last dime to get energy drinks and junk food 1/8 of a mile from the house instead of eating before he leaves the house. Do all of these little incidences matter? Not really. What really matters is the thing behind it that drives him to go that way. I'm fully aware he is what he is, and there are certain things I will have to accept. But I know from my own personal experience that when you get that faith in your heart, 90% of that changes because you see what's right and wrong and what ultimately matters and what doesn't so clear that it is never a question of the choice you're going to make. I see him struggle every day in his head. He's trying so hard with his head. What can I do to help him make that shift from his head to his heart? Interestingly enough, and you probably won't like this answer, but generally what helps someone make that shift from head to heart is failure. And Thomas Keating says that every saint ultimately has to go through a series of necessary humiliations before they finally let go of their own ego, of that what I would call the deceived self, the small self, to really move into love and to what's truly important. When we're egocentric and life is all about us and we're looking at trying to make ourselves happy, it's difficult. And it sounds to me, and I don't know, but a little bit like, oh, well, when we're interested primarily in doing the right thing, we're trying to be good, then eventually I think we just run out of momentum. I always say the best of the flesh is the worst of the flesh, and it's It's not until we see that what we're doing isn't working until we're typically willing to take the steps necessary to begin to make all of that change. And my prayer would be certainly for him that he would come to a point where he recognizes that this way doesn't work for him. I think that from your perspective, how can you help him? You know, if you can be around people who truly get it and who live a different way, if he can, because the easiest way to kind of become faith-filled and I think to be a Christian is to really meet a Christian. I mean, if you can find somebody who truly walks by faith and has a profound faith, someone who I think maybe he could meet and be a little bit confused by, be confounded by, someone that might make him question, that's the other way I know that sometimes people begin to shift and maybe move out of their kind of their own world a little bit. I mean, I think you see his heart and what you're describing. He wants to do the right thing. The problem is his instincts and the things that are important to him are such that right now it's a sacrifice for him to do that. One thing I really appreciate about what you wrote is I watch my husband struggle, and I do hope, you know, I know he's not doing it perfectly, but obviously if he's at least trying, that is a step. And at one level, there's a level of conviction he probably has. And so he's trying to do the right thing. And for that, at one level, you know, love equals suffering. I mean, if I love someone, oftentimes I'm willing to suffer for the sake of, for their sake. You know, it's just that he's doing it out of force of will, it sounds like, and not necessarily out of his heart yet. So probably one of two things will happen. Either A, he gets to meet somebody who does get it and that he can admire and that ultimately that can help him because he just is compelled. Sometimes that can happen in the flash of an eye. I mean, if he's able maybe, for instance, to, you know, I would say go on a sometimes a retreat, a men's retreat or something. He may come across something that touches him. Certainly, this is not the type of person I would give up on. I mean, I think this is the type of person, again, who's trying, and I pray that they're able through this, you know, to find some answers. It's just he's still at that place where he's trying to do it. I mean, that's the problem in his own flesh. So I'll be praying for him that he meets the right people because really in the long run, you're going to want him to be able to do it again from his heart. And you're just watching him struggle, which at least means that he's trying. But also remember, you never know the end of the story by the beginning. And I don't even know what's good or bad. And sometimes someone like this, when they kind of come face to face with what they're living for, how it doesn't work, my prayer is that you guys aren't hurt in his train wreck while he's still trying to figure all of this out. I wish I had a better answer, but try to get him around really good people. And then if he does begin to fall, and when I say fall, that doesn't mean he goes back to his affair partner. I think typically he'll need some sort of crisis in his life. A lot of times it comes with a death or the loss of a job. I had another person similar to this who lost his job last year, and it was a life-changing event for him and exactly what he needed. And it was the thing that finally got him to begin to look at it different and to begin to let go. So he had to hit bottom, so to speak. So I pray that happens in a way that's not too painful to the family, but that it brings an amazing blessing to y'all in the long run. Phone numbers. Hi, Rick. I wanted to seek your opinion in regards to changing phone numbers in order to avoid being contacted by the affair partner. I changed all my information in order to show my wife I meant to avoid all contact with my affair partner. However, when I approached my wife about her changing her phone number to avoid any contact with her affair partner, she said that it was something she couldn't do because her number was known, and even if her affair partner called, I should trust her to say the right things. She recently disclosed to me the possibility of an ex-boyfriend getting a hold of her phone number because she sent it in a message through a relative of the guy. She said she did that a couple of months back and did so because she was hurt and wanted to apologize for what she had done with the fair partner. That is how things started. I don't quite agree with her position on the whole idea that she needs to have that number. I see it as her wanting me to trust her, but I'm not there yet. Please advise. It's funny, I'm actually speaking on a Thursday night on Affair Proofing Your Marriage at Shoreline Church here in Austin, Texas. And, you know, one of the things I say all the time is that people never fall because they're weak. They only fall because they're strong. And ultimately, they think they can handle it. And so when someone tells me they don't need to change a phone number, then I have two thoughts. One, I would much rather assume that there's no way I can handle the call. The person who knows that they won't say the right thing or potentially might not say the right thing, it'll always be the one who's safe because they don't make that assumption that nothing would happen. They make the assumption something would happen, and for that reason, out of their own integrity and their own sense of safety and their own desire to protect their mate and themselves and their children and their life, you know, they change phone numbers. I mean, I look at myself, and bottom line, I'm a human wrecking ball. I don't trust me. I know it wouldn't be safe. And so, you know, it seems like such a small thing to do. The problem is having to admit that I need to change a phone number also, you know, the price of sobriety, the price of breaking free, the price of it's weird. If you want to gain your life, ultimately you have to lose it. And what we're really losing is our pride and our ego. And I think oftentimes, you know, I doubt that your wife has a desire. I mean, she may, but there's a really good chance she doesn't. The problem is it's a pride issue to think that I would have to be weak. But ultimately, what we're trying to do in recovery is totally give up the concept that we can manage it. To accept the fact that we can't, that we're powerless, that ultimately if God doesn't step in, there's no way it won't happen. So at times, you know, the only way some people are convinced is they have to make the mistake and do it again until they're finally convinced maybe they can't manage it. I hope that she doesn't have to go through that. The other thing that it might reveal too, though, when you're asking her to change the phone number, if she's felt in the past that you've tried to control her or she's still bitter or angry toward you, then there's also the possibility that just your request is the thing that ultimately kind of, you know, causes this internal angst in her that would make her not want to answer or not want to give up the phone number. There's in the cycle of change, one of the stages is called contemplative. In the contemplative stage of change, we are 50-50. 50% of us really wants to change. 50% of us really doesn't want to change. And in that homeostasis, that ambivalence, what happens is if you put 10 pounds of pressure telling someone to change, so you put on that balance scale, so 10 pounds goes on the change, you need to give up your phone number, the other person, because it's about remaining 50-50, will immediately put 10 pounds of pressure back on not doing it. It's almost like they continually, the harder you press one way, the harder they press the other to keep it kind of balanced. One of the things I do with people like that sometimes is I tell them I don't think they're strong enough to change their phone number. I don't think they're capable. In other words, I take you can't do it position, and a lot of times that is enough to get them to say, well, yes, I can, and begin to maybe admit the other side of that ambivalence. And if there's, again, bitterness, I see this frequently with women and some men too. I see it both directions. It feels like when their mate is trying to manage their recovery, then immediately they get very testy and get very defensive and just flat out refuse to do it. Something that I suggest in this sort of situation, I don't know if your wife is listening to this, but you might get out of the way as much as you can. One thing you might suggest is you might suggest that she really pray about it and see what God tells her. That was one of the things that that Stephanie used to do with me. And I found that when I was doing it because of my faith, because it's what I felt God was telling me, you know, it's kind of God's direction, I could do it for God. I just wasn't at a place yet that it felt right for whatever reason to do it for Stephanie. And eventually, as I kind of healed in my own heart and my own wounds, that changed. So if she's someone that faith is important to her, you really might ask her to pray about it. If it's something that I will try to see if we can't post my lecture that I'm doing Thursday night on fair-proofing your marriage. We also have some resources on relapse prevention and kind of setting boundaries. I don't know if she'd be willing to go through some of that with you. But in the long run, the best way to stay safe, especially when it's been involved with other people, is just simply to admit that I can't do it. I have nothing to prove, not trying to prove anything. You know, all I want to do is I want to not worry about that next call. And I don't want to have to, I just want to get as far away from the ditch as possible. The strange thing is, in recovery, we can be 100 miles down the road, but we're still only 10 feet from the ditch. And if we're honest with ourselves, then I think maybe we can choose to drive away from the ditch. And changing phone numbers is a great way in the long run to drive away from a ditch. So, again, Lord willing, that will happen. So here's the next one. Hi, Rick. Hope all is well. After being betrayed, then participating on the EMS, forgiving my husband, reconnecting with him again, he decides not to move back to our apartment, yet he's waiting on the Lord to complete his work on him and feels that he struggles with shame. At the same time, I'm feeling I'm disconnecting and struggling to wait on the Lord. My question is, should I tell him that he has until a specific date to come back? This is so that he can make a decision whether to come back or not. At least I know that I can move on with my life or wait for him. I don't want to be an obstacle for God's plan for my husband. I just feel lonely and miss him so much. I think there really might come a point for a decision. Knowing your particular case, I would hope that maybe that you and I can talk about that, and maybe with him. I believe he's trying to work through something. I don't know what it is and what it's going to take to kind of clear that hurdle. But before you kind of set that, I think it would be good for all of us to sit down and talk and figure out a little bit of what's going on. I do understand you want to move on with your life, and I know you don't want to be an obstacle, and I certainly understand why you would feel incredibly lonely. I'm wondering, and I know this isn't much of an answer to the people here on this question. It's just this one's complicated because I'm really aware of the case. If there's a way that we would be able to talk, and so would you mind calling the office if you get this? And I'll also email you, and let's try to set up a time. Let me read this one more time and try to answer it for other people on the call. He's waiting on the Lord to complete his work in him and feels that he struggles with shame. At the same time, I'm feeling disconnected and struggling to wait on the Lord. Should I tell him he has until a specific date to come back? There is certainly a time, I think, when you want to give somebody who's ambivalent a time to come back. The problem with it is, and it's kind of back to the other number, Understand that if you sit there and tell someone that they've got to come back by such and such a day, then in the long run, if you say do this, they'll sit there and go the other way. So how you say things to people is incredibly important. I would almost say, you know, the message of, and even this isn't necessarily a great solution, but the message being delivered from the perspective of, you know, after this date, I'm moving on, rather than you've got to come back, because it's apparent to me at that point that, you know, you can't do this, and I understand, and I'm not upset, but I've just got to go on and get a life. The message of you moving on is very different than the message of you've got to come back. And it actually allows somebody far more latitude in terms of their own internal civil war of how to look at things and how to respond. The other problem, though, with hard deadlines is that sometimes if people are working on things, they may not have completed kind of what they're working through, and they do it because they feel like they have no other option. So there needs to be a communication between the two people about exactly, I think, clarifying what are the goals and how are we going to do it and how do we see progress. Because if, you know, like we did, we set a time and it didn't work, we need to figure out what the barriers are. And that would actually end up being then a thing for a joint session for us. So I certainly hope that helps a little bit. sorry, the next question. For those who need lots of help, what makes ARC better than other affair recovery books, videos, therapists, preachers, etc.? Well, first off, then you got to assume that I think that, but because there are some really good people out there. I mean, I think what's unique about the Affair Recovery Center, this is an interesting question. I think what's unique is that typically a book will give you a specific set of action, but it's addressing more or less a particular type of problem. It's difficult to write a book that's going to cover all aspects, because infidelity, there's so many different types of infidelity. You know, we talk about six different types of categories of affairs. Well, that's important, but, you know, there are also 16, really 18 different response patterns that people have. And there's also multiple power or ways the power structure is set up within a couple. And if you're not looking at, and there's also like 16 different types of almost personality types that have affairs. So when you start combining all of those pieces, the power structure, the type of affair, the type of person that had the affair, the type of person and response patterns, the person they're married to, I would say that one of the things we look at ARC that does make it very unique is our ability to make, I think, customize the program a bit more to specifically what people need. Somebody who's married to someone that their response pattern is extreme anger, I think there's a very unique set of kind of treatment recommendations that person needs. In the previous question, you've got somebody who I know really wants to come home, has broken things off, but still has a great deal of ambivalence and is having difficulty ending the separation. And that's a situation probably where you're dealing more with limerence and how you come out of limerence. And that's a very unique sort of situation. And most books won't write about limerence per se and that sort of ambivalence. And so one of the things that I think we provide is just a broader or a more specific treatment plan. Another thing that I think is an advantage for a therapist, therapy's great. It's one time a week. I think oftentimes people need a lot more than that. And so if you can have a system that provides not only specific coaching for where you're at, but also support from other people. I think the community that we all needed a community, I think, to begin to work through this, because this blooming thing is so isolating. And when you can, you know, get online, begin to email people, talk to other people who are like you and mentors who've already worked through it, who understand and can let you know that you're not crazy. What you're feeling is normal. I think that's also very helpful. Another thing is, I think that it may be difficult to find, I'm afraid, at this point, even though that is changing. Being able to listen to other experts through the ARC radio is really important. Another thing that makes it really unique, we have anonymity, such as a book provides anonymity or maybe videos, but on the other hand, we also provide, again, community. And most times when you're dealing with community or therapists or preachers, there's a blush factor that makes it really difficult, and I think it takes away a lot of that blush factor. So in a sense, I think what's unique is we're really trying to hit and provide for people, I think, a more complete package that's catered more to what they need. The other thing is most videos or intensive weekends, my concern has always been you go there, you're there for 3 days, you get wonderful stuff, but then it's up to you more or less to try to implement it. And one of the things we are really committed to at the ARC, and it's a program in progress, but it's continuing to provide support for a year afterwards where you continue to meet with a group of people, you continue to have support. As someone knows, it's worked through like 12-step issues or 12-step groups that you don't want it. It's, you know, you want it to be where it's something that you're not ashamed of, where it kind of begins to be a part of the story ultimately of who you are and something that you heal from. So in a sense, I just think it gives a much broader range, I guess, what makes us different, or better, but very different than books and videos and maybe therapists is. Not only does it, you know, again, it contains very specific treatment planning, which I think is probably the best around personally. That I have no qualms about. It also provides a lot of support. It also provides anonymity. It provides convenience. That's the other thing. I mean, typically if you're trying to do a therapist or preachers or whatever, you both have to be in the same place. At least here at the ARC, you can be wherever you need to be. All you need is a telephone. So those are the things, and thanks for the question. I wasn't trying to make a plug on ARC. I didn't write that question, by the way, but that, I think, is what really sets us apart from a lot of other programs. Great. Weary. many of the hurt spouses lately have been talking about just hitting a point where they are so weary. The forward movement doesn't seem to be happening, that the hurt spouse seems to have to do so much work to get better whether we stay with our spouse or not, while the unfaithful spouse in some cases seems to be doing only as little as necessary to advance the couple's recovery process. Could you explain that phenomenon for us, please? Yeah, sometimes I get really weary. I get that. You know, one of the things Leslie says, and it's very, very appropriate, is in her article, if you haven't read that, Rediscovering Camelot, is that the path of recovery for the hurt spouse is so much more intense than the path of recovery for the one who was unfaithful. Partially because, one, if the unfaithful spouse is not the one typically that's having to get over. Now, again, I want to be careful because there are different types of affairs, and so this doesn't quite fit all. But for many people who have been unfaithful, especially if, you know, it's a secret they've been carrying, if it's been a long-standing problem that they work through. For them, when they go into recovery, it's like, and they begin to deal with this, I mean, they are probably feeling better than they have felt in a long time, because just walking in the light, being honest, being able to start, being intimate, being real, being transparent, really has its own blessings. And so they feel, you know, wonderful. And their tendency to look and feel about the marriage in a positive way goes up very, very quickly. For the unfaithful, for the hurt spouse, however, just working through the pain created, the trauma created by the betrayal, the attachment distress that's created as a result of what's happened. And depending on kind of where you come from in life, that can be incredibly difficult. You're dealing with reminders every day. You're dealing with fears. Oftentimes it feels like there's a minefield. Again, my experience is for some people that goes on for as long as 18 months. If it goes on longer than that, there's probably other issues. And in particular, if you're not seeing your mate do what's necessary to, if you don't see them taking care of business, it is, you know, it's a very lonely journey. I at the EMS this weekend, it was interesting. There was one gentleman, and the fact is, she's been doing, I think, the lion's share of the work. And, you know, it's really hard for her because he's the one that's blown up the world, but he's kind of like, you know, everything's good, I'm doing fine, that whole thing, you just need to flat get over this. And, you know, when I'm working with people individually, the hurt spouse, I sit there and say, you know, ultimately, you've got to work really hard, I believe, at making things safe for your mate, to give them assurance. There's nothing like having a mate who's willing to really do the work, to do their own individual work, to figure out how they got here. One person I recommended this weekend for this very reason, I said, you need to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And because I knew that if he did 90 meetings in 90 days, that ultimately his mate would begin to start, I mean, there'd be at least a little hope that, you know, we're not going back to the same thing. It's really hard when someone isn't willing to stay in counseling or go to meetings where you're able to see the actions that they're taking to believe that maybe in the future it'll be difficult. And I think that weariness comes a lot of times from a lack of hope, and the lack of hope comes from, or the fear of nothing's going to change because you don't see the other person kind of pitching in to help. You know, one of the things I've been saying I'm going to do and I've got to get it done is a course just for the unfaithful spouse. And much of that course is really going to be aimed at, you know, how do you begin to explore things, exercises and pieces you can do on your own journey of recovery to help protect your family, to help understand yourself, to help heal whatever it was within you that even created this to begin with. And I think if there are courses like that or actions like that that the hurt spouse takes, that it really helps the hurt spouse. Another thing that makes it really weary for the hurt spouse is if they haven't come to the place yet where they can just kind of process and talk about it, and they're having to kind of pretend like everything's okay when it's really not. I always get really disturbed when I have the questions here on the forum on Mondays when they say, you know, my mate just says kind of get over it. And I understand that a lot of people would like their mate to get over it. The intrusive thoughts don't just end like that. And the biggest obstacle for many, many people in terms of moving beyond it is their mate and an unwillingness on their part to address issues. I was dealing with a case here in my office and a couple of weeks ago, and the problem is, you know, the guy's been, who has the ability actually to get rid of the other person, but has failed to do so. And for whatever reason, it's made it incredibly difficult for his mate, because she's sitting there feeling all the time that in many ways there's more loyalty. And so also the loyalty issue, if you feel like you're still having to walk, but the other person isn't kind of walking with you or helping, and maybe you do disagree about what course of action needs to be done, such as changing a phone number, but at least if there's conversation about it, there's forward movement. So again, I often think that whole thing of people's weariness really comes from a discouragement or a hopelessness that comes oftentimes because they don't see their mate doing things. And maybe it's that their mate doesn't know what to do. Sometimes it's because, like in one of the earlier questions, you've got somebody that's really struggling with something and they don't know how to move beyond it. But at least maybe if, as long as there's still conversation and we're talking, there's still a way to work through it. It's when that communication begins to break down and the other person says, quit talking about it, then it becomes very lonely and weariness sets in. What do you do when you're stuck? I don't know. I've never been stuck in my life, but let me see here. I'm joking, I've been stuck. My husband seems to think he should be getting maximum benefit out of minimum effort. He keeps teasing me by acting like he's actually getting it and is willing to work on his own issues. However, as soon as I start to relax and warm up to him, all efforts in this direction just seem to fade off into the sunset. We've been stuck in this never-ending cycle before. Cycle forever. It feels to me like he's now more concerned with looking good on the outside than being good on the inside. I don't even think he knows the difference between the two, which really scares me. I've told him for years that I don't like being married to a man in the mask, and that I need him to get real and to be real with me. Then, when I say anything like this, he just looks at me like I have rocks in my head. He gets all upset and says, this is all there is to me, but it's just not enough for you. It's never good enough for you. At this point, he usually redoubles his efforts at polishing his armor and sharpening his sword. Apparently, I'm not really good at explaining needs to him in a way that he can understand. Any thoughts? The first thought I've got is in marriage, if he believes that it's about being good enough, and if he's living in what I would call a requirement-based system versus a love-based system, then in that requirement-based system, he's always going to believe what makes all you're looking for or what makes it acceptable is his ability to meet the requirement. And when he doesn't do that, then ultimately, he's missed the mark and he's got to redouble his efforts and try stuff all over again. My first thought is, if he'd be willing to do it, when I get, right now it doesn't help us, I don't have it this week, but something like the Unfaithful Spouse course where he begins to have other men that he sees with an attitude that really maybe something he doesn't have a way to understand it, a way to see it. I assume that most people really don't get it because they maybe have a sense of what it looks like, but they don't even know what it really looks like. When I see people who really get it, like I was saying very early in the call, the best way to get into recovery and to kind of get moving is to meet somebody who's already really in recovery where you can begin to see a little bit of what it looks like. And I would suspect that maybe it's never been modeled and he may not even know the people that can do that for him. If you haven't done 911, I would say do 911. At least maybe that helps. I mean, maybe you've already done 911, but if you haven't, that would be something to do. Also, there's RCA, which is a recovery program for couples, and maybe a group like that where you meet together as a couple might work better for him. It, in the sense that it allows him to, the two of you to have a format or a forum where you can talk and process. And if he's willing to redouble his efforts, then maybe that's one of the ways he could redouble his efforts, where you both have a program you can begin to go through that would really help on an ongoing basis. If you've done 911 marriage already, then our EMS, I would recommend getting involved in the Married for Life program, because what that begins to talk about is much more about what an authentic heart connection looks like, not what does a performance-based system look like. And so frequently, if you can get him into something where he can see something different, I mean, I do find a lot of times that people's hearts are good, and, you know, but they really don't. They're still kind of living in a paradigm that doesn't work. You know, like I quote, you know, Einstein, I love the Einstein quote, you know, you can never solve a problem with the same consciousness that created it. And ultimately, in the recovery process, you've got to learn to look at things very differently. And that would be true for both of you, not just for him. And, you know, potentially, you know, there's a way, I would hope, there's a way that the two of you can get together. But the group thing as a couple would almost be the first thing I would start. Even if it's a Bible study at a church or a small group in that sense, give yourself a place where you can process and work together and talk and begin to develop the common language. And, you know, the image management, you know, I understand that you're talking about looking good on the outside, and that's really scary to you. You know, back to what I really believe, the problem is we're all disoriented and deceived and egocentric and born 100% totally self-centered, thinking that somehow it's about us. And that little small self, the false self, is such a, you know, it's sad because we have so much more potential if we can move to the center and understand that there's something outside of us that's bigger than us. If we can begin to let go of our pride and our image and just get on with life. I mean, one of the things I try to teach all of my men, I've said this on the call before, but I'll say it again, is that, you know, life isn't about you. You're supposed to be about life, and that you're really not that important, so quit worrying about it. And life is hard, so don't be surprised when it's hard, and that you're not in control. So give up the illusion that you can. Don't even try to get there. Instead, the way to move from that eccentric position of self-centeredness and our own kind of, you know, me trying to be like God is to accept that I'm not, and to have the courage to let go and to be nothing, and to accept there's something much more. Because to me, the only way you ever become all-powerful is by becoming totally lowly. And that's very paradoxical, but I think all true spirituality really is paradoxical. I mean, like Jesus taught, the way up is always the way down, that it's through descent. It's not through accomplishment and ascent, that if you want to gain your life, you lose it. And hopefully, you know, he can meet somebody who gets that, and that can help move him on. The other thing that maybe you could do that would be helpful, I just thought of this, would be potentially reading a book. Just out loud to each other and talking about it. I don't know why this one just popped to mind, but something like Blue Like Jazz, I don't know why, but Blue Like Jazz might be a good book. There's Heaven Knows What, I think, is his other book, Donald Miller. So something by him, maybe that's something you could read that would be helpful. But try to find a common place that y'all can connect. Hope that answers that question. Let's see. There's several people on the line here. That is all the written questions. Does anybody else have a question they'd like to either type out or... you could speak up if you wanted, because I certainly don't mind. We've still got about 10 minutes here if somebody else has a question they'd like to ask. I'm being quiet on the line here, giving people a chance to type. Those of you who are listening to the call, the way this system works, people can actually type things, or they potentially could speak up. So far, ain't nothing happening. Okay, then I guess this will be a 45. Oh, there we go. How do you know when it's just too late because love is dead? Ah, great question. And that is a very, very complicated question. What I found is if love ever existed, and love, if you were in love and you fell out of love, then you also can fall back in love. So the thing, is it too late because love is dead? I would say never. Because if you're looking at the feelings to dictate whether or not, you know, you don't go forward, I just think I've worked with far too many people who've come in and told me, you know, they have no feeling, they're completely apathetic, that, you know, they can't ever fathom having any feelings for this person again, they don't know where they went, but that's that, and they are passionately in love with their mate at this point, and so that happens all of the time. People's feelings come back. Too late, though, when you know it's too late, never, I think, because love is dead. There are things you can do to have love come back. I think when someone's heart is completely hard, when someone's really pulling away, they're not willing to, when they're dangerous. I've got somebody just last week, I said, you need to put your tennis shoes on and run, because the problem is they're not addressing this issue, and I worry about your health. You know, I just think there's too much of a chance that eventually you could be exposed if you continue with them. Maybe to AIDS, HIV, and so that would be a case that I think oftentimes it's a really good reason to leave somebody, not willing to address a problem, not seeing the problem, being contemplative about the problem, who's had a chance to address that problem. Sometimes the best thing for those people is to let them go. If love is dead, you know, then I would say you probably need to get some individual help regarding what it takes to make that come back. Let me just talk a second about love is dead, because I see that one frequently enough. There are several reasons that love goes dead, and I don't know, because this is just guest number 5, and I don't know if this is male or female. Women in particular, because I believe, and I heard this from Frank Pittman, and I agree with Frank on this, that men are so relationally retarded that ultimately they have, thank you, this is female, men are so relationally retarded, they have the ability to oftentimes have an affair, but their heart is still connected. For women, usually they don't do things until their heart is disconnected. So sometimes when you've got a woman having an affair, they've lost their feelings for their mate long ago. Usually the reason, and this is a hurt spouse, usually the reason people lose their love for their mate is resentment and bitterness and just pain and disappointment. For love to come back, one of the things that has to happen is, in particular for, again, women, not, again, I'm speaking generality, so I want to be careful because this isn't always true. But frequently, love dies because hearts have become attached elsewhere. So one of the things, if you would like love to return, you need to really think, what is my heart truly attached to? Because you won't have the ability to have feel or attach to your mate if you're attached to something else. It would be too crazy for you. The second thing is, if you've got resentment and bitterness and you haven't and there's a lot of pain, you won't be able to have feelings back typically for the other person. Frequently after someone has been betrayed, the problem is many of the aspects that you loved about that other person, the characteristics that you cared about, often the betrayal destroys those items. So if you loved your mate because he had a great deal of integrity or character, or he was somebody he really admired because of this and, you know, his job. And then suddenly he's lost his job. You find he has no character. You know, he's just, you know, he's this. And you suddenly see him as kind of a dark, you know, black golem sort of object, you know, that you just kind of loathe and hold in contempt. Yeah, there you go. Then in the long run, it's difficult to admire someone like that. And so you're right on line with where I was going. And until they begin to address the issues, and if they're contemplative and they don't see it, it is very difficult to be able to have that place of respect and admiration and to be able to feel safe. If they just want you to kind of live with them and accept them as they are, I can tell you right now that's not a lot of love on their part for you, or love even for themselves. And so it is really difficult to have feelings for them if they're not addressing the issues. When I do see situations where I do know love comes back, I remember somebody wrote something once and I thought it was pretty funny. She said, I know that there must have been some good reason that I married this person, but for the life of me, it took at least a year for me to begin to see what that was. And she said, what saved me and was the fact that I watched his integrity addressing this, taking responsibility for his own issues and actions and what had happened. And I grew to just admire the man's tenacity and his willingness to be loving toward me, even when I was being horrible toward him. It makes it easier, obviously, to love someone who's doing that. Someone who is hurting you continually, not addressing the issue and doesn't care what they've done to you, I'm not even sure in the long run if that person is, as I teach at the ARC, at the Fair Recovery Center, you don't, there are two types of forgiveness. One type of forgiveness is vertical, and that's between you and God. And that's the you know, we say that's the gift you give yourself, because you don't really want to hold an offense from another person. But the second type of forgiveness, the horizontal forgiveness, is really about reconciliation. And the determining factor of reconciliation has far more to do with safety. And what determines safety is the other person's ability to accept responsibility for what they've done, to address what they've done, to work at moving beyond things. And if they don't do that, reconciliation, in my mind, is not necessarily even a good idea. It's not in your best interest, and I don't know that it's really in their best interest. So I would recommend, if he's not addressing it, he doesn't understand those particular issues, you do some sort of intervention. This weekend we had, again, one couple of EMS came just for that very reason, because I mean, he did not even see the blooming issue. But in 3 days of kind of intense workshop, I actually got him seeing the issue pretty clearly. And maybe you've already been to EMS, I don't know. Or maybe you've done 911. But again, if you don't get him around other people who are talking differently and looking at it differently and responding differently, then he may not see it. And if he doesn't see it, he won't be safe. And if he's not safe, to me, what makes it too late isn't because the love is dead. It's because the other person's not doing what it's going to take to make it safe for you. So hopefully, at some point, you can find a way, or he'll find a way to get his mind around that, because it's going to be difficult. No, I'm not even sure it would be safe for you to sit there and be there if he didn't. Okay, now we're about out of time. So I want to thank everybody for joining the call. There are some great questions, and I look forward to talking with you guys again next week. So everybody take care, and this is Rick signing off to healing. Bye-bye.